This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Jim Bertel. Lebanese protesters stormed the foreign ministry in Beirut on Saturday as anger exploded over a deadly blast homeless and killed 158 people. Demonstrators marched through streets ravaged by the blast, gathering in the central Martyrs Square as their grief gave way to rage. Police used tear gas against groups of demonstrators, rocks and sticks on the fringes of the main gathering, which was relatively peaceful despite high tensions since the blast on Tuesday. U.S. President Donald Trump says he will join a conference call with Lebanon's president and other world leaders on Sunday to discuss aid to the country.
This was an event like the world has not seen for a long time. Horrible event. We'll be having a conference call on Sunday with President Macron, leaders of Lebanon, and leaders from various parts of the world. Everyone wants to help.
At least 18 people have been killed and more than 125 injured in southern India in a plane crash that took place when the aircraft overshot a runway. Reuters' Olivia Chan reports.
The death toll from an Indian passenger aircraft accident has risen to at least 18. A senior official said on Saturday at least 16 people have been severely injured. The flight data recorder and cockpit voice recorder have been recovered from sight. The Air India Express plane was repatriating Indians stranded in Dubai due to the coronavirus pandemic. Boeing 737 plane skidded off the tabletop runway of Calicut International Airport in heavy rain on Friday, crashing nose first into the ground. The plane's pilot and the co-pilot were killed in the accident.
This is VOA News. U.S. intelligence officials believe Russia is working against presidential candidate Joe Biden before November's election. AP Sagar Magani reports.
America's counterintelligence chief says Moscow's doing a variety of things to denigrate Biden, while some people linked to the Kremlin are boosting President Trump's re-election bid. At the same time, William Evanino says intelligence officials believe China does not want the term, viewing him as unpredictable. He says Beijing's boosting its public criticism of the president and efforts to shape American opinion. His statement comes after House Democrats complain the intelligence community has been withholding specific information about the foreign interference threat before November. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Turning now to the coronavirus pandemic, globally, more than 721,000 deaths have been confirmed as a result of COVID-19, while 19.4 million people have been infected. The African Union says aggressive and bold action is needed to combat the COVID-19 outbreak on the continent. More than 1 million cases have been reported across Africa, but officials warn the real number is likely larger, citing the absence of comprehensive testing in some countries. China is slamming the United States for imposing sanctions in response to Beijing's crackdown in Hong Kong, capping a dramatic week of deteriorating relations between the world's two biggest economies. In the toughest U.S. action on Hong Kong since China imposed a sweeping new security law on the territory, Washington imposed sanctions on a group of Chinese and Hong Kong officials, including the city's leader, Carrie Lam. Military officials say at least 9 people were killed. A bomb exploded at an army base in the Somali capital Mogadishu on Saturday. The attack targeted a compound near Somalia's National Stadium, where soldiers from the Somali National Army are stationed. A Venezuelan court sentenced 2 former U.S. soldiers to 20 years in prison for their role in a failed incursion aimed at ousting President Nicolas Maduro in early May. The 2 former Green Berets admitted to participating in the May 4th operation. The Trump administration has denied any direct involvement. France on Saturday dispatched aircraft and technical advisors to Mauritius after appealed for urgent assistance to contain a worsening oil spill polluting the island nation's famed reefs, lagoons, and oceans. Rough seas have hampered efforts to stop fuel leaking from a ship which ran aground 2 weeks ago. For more news, go to voanews.com. I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
Expose the corruption and utilize institutions like the Public Protector to lodge their complaints, and also utilize and even open criminal cases against those who are involved in corruption, because corruption is purely a criminal act.
The South African Public Protector launches a series of investigations into allegations of corruption.
We do not prevent anybody from registering so long as they are qualified. And let us also remember that there's division of labor. When it comes to security matters, we do not come in. We can only collaborate with the security services to make sure that there is law and order. We are playing a part effectively, and we are encouraging eligible applicants to turn up in their numbers so they can register.
The Electoral Commission of Ghana compiles a voter list in the run-up to the December polls.
We will continue to inundate the court with exhibits and evidence until we make a historical record that they failed to respond to an ongoing genocide, despite all the evidence being available to them.
And a U.S.-based law firm submits evidence of atrocities in Nigeria to the prosecutor at the International Criminal Court. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The South African Public Protector, an anti-graft organization, has launched a series of investigations into allegations of corruption across the country. This following complaints and reports of the violation of the procurement process for personal protective equipment in the fight to limit the spread of the coronavirus. Public Protector Busisiwe Nkwabane says her organization has also launched inquiries into issues of conflict of interest and unethical behavior in some of the cases to determine whether procurement processes at state institutions were followed. Ms. Nkwabane tells me that South Africans should file complaints with the organization when there are suspicions that public officials are engaging in acts of graft.
We have done an own initiative investigation in the Eastern Cape, where there is procurement or alleged procurement of scooters to be utilized as ambulances. So we will have checked. But also there's also in the Eastern Cape a lot of complaints we've received from the members of provincial legislature. But then also we have initiated an investigation around Gauteng. You've heard, I think, in the news where the spokesperson of the president himself, in fact, Ms. Diko and the husband, the MEC for Health, are implicated or to have been involved in also procurement, regular procurement of or supply of the protective equipments. And again, that borders around the issue of conflict of interest. And also we will have to check what procurement process was followed.
There are concerns that senior figures in government have their relations and sometimes their children participating or having contract with the same government, bringing concerns about conflict of interest and unethical way of doing business in South Africa. As a public protector, yes, what are you doing about this?
We've received a complaint, especially about the contract which was awarded to the son of the president, one organization called AfriForum. They've lodged a complaint, so we're still looking to that particular complaint and to check whether it falls within our mandate, because remember, we only investigate a public administration or anything in state affairs. And on the allegations that other ministers or politicians, their children are also involved, we won't have jurisdiction over members of or people who are politicians who are not members of the executive, meaning who are not ministers, presidents, or those who are not employed by governments. But then, if then a complaint can be lodged against public servants who have awarded the contract to those family members, definitely we will investigate.
What time period or time frame do you have to investigate all these allegations you enumerated?
Currently, we have a team which constitute of 10 investigators, senior investigators, from one from each province, because we've got 9 provincial offices. And then that team is led by the executive manager, who is based here at head office. And the investigations normally of conduct failure or corruption, they normally take up to 2 years to investigate. But on this one, we have requested them to shorten the period to at least conclude and finalize most of these complaints within a period of a year.
Some activists and civil society groups in South Africa are calling for laws to be enacted to bar officials and their relations from doing business with either the local provincial government or the government itself. What is your stance on that?
You know, we've got various laws already in South Africa. It's just a question of implementing those laws. When it comes to members of the executive, especially the MECs, the ministers, the president, the deputy president, the premiers, we do have the law called Executive Members Ethics Act, where the public protector is the only institution which is having the mandate to investigate their conduct. And that legislation is directly from the Constitution, Section 96 of the Constitution of South Africa. And it's very clear that those members of the executive, they should conduct themselves ethically. They should not do business with the state, even their families. They should not even expose themselves to a conflict of interest.
What is the message here to the people of South Africa following all these allegations and the inquiry that the organization has launched into them?
You know, where the people of South Africa, a lot of them have lodged this complaint, and it shows that they also know that the public protector is the only constitutional institution which will operate independently without fear or favor, and will not be dictated the terms by any public servant or by any executive. So I'm also calling upon them not to keep quiet, but to expose the corruption and utilize institutions like the public protector to lodge their complaints, and also utilize and even open criminal cases against those who are involved in corruption, because corruption is purely a criminal act.
Busisiwe Nkwabane is South Africa's public protector. She spoke with me from the capital, Pretoria. Mohamed Ould Bilal is Mauritania's new prime minister. This after President Mohamed Ould Ghazouani appointed a prominent public administrator as prime minister hours after his predecessor Ismaël Ould Bédé Ould Cheikh Sidiya and his entire cabinet resigned. Local media reports the resignations follow a parliamentary inquiry report into former President Mohamed Ould Abdelaziz and associated officials. For more about the expectations of the new prime minister and his soon-to-be-announced government, I reach Ambassador Mokhtar Dahi, a top former Mauritanian envoy to Italy.
The resign of the former prime minister and the appointment of the new prime minister are a sign of good democratic practices in Mauritania. However, it was to remember that constitutionally, the appointment of the prime minister is the competence, full competence of the president of the republic. Some political analysts don't exclude the bridge between the resign of the former prime minister and the parliamentary inquiry commission, in which some former ministers are cited in this report. The new prime minister, Mohamed Ould Bilal, is a brilliant engineer who has an excellent CV and strong experiences in the public administration. All the Mauritanian public opinion are waiting for the list of the new cabinet, and they have strong hope that the new government will be a government of full and high competencies.
Ambassador Mokhtar, does that mean that the former prime minister did not meet the aspirations of the people of Mauritania?
The Parliamentary Inquiry Commission were about the management of the government of the former regime of the former president of the Republic, Mohamed Ould Abdel Aziz. But some ministers of the government of Badawi Sheikh Sidiya, who resigned today, were also ministers under Ould Abdel Aziz. In addition to that, the appointment of the new cabinet can be read that the president, Mohamed Ould Ghazouani, what a new governmental team in order to accelerate the execution of the of his program, in particular his program in struggle against inequalities, disparities, and others.
What do you say to those who are criticizing the president that promises he made, including improving their living conditions, have yet to be kept? Do you think their concerns are justified?
We made in Mauritania a few days ago the annual assessment of the first year of President Ghazouani, of Ghazouani presidency. I can confirm you that majorities and opposition and independent personalities are agree that the first year of Ghazouani presidency was a success. Was success in political level by calming down the political sphere. We can cite regular dialogue with the leader of the opposition, regular consultations with the historical leaders of opposition, Ahmed Ould Dada, Mas'oud Ould Belkhair, Biram Ould Abeid, and others. Was also the first year of Ghazouani presidency was also success in social level and struggle against inequalities. We can give an example by the operationalization of delegation to Azor, which has a mission to eradicate the inequalities, disparities between people and between communities. And this delegation was funded by 43 billions of Ouya, Mauritanian money.
What do you think are the expectations of the people in Mauritania regarding the new government following the appointment of the new prime minister?
The expectations of Mauritanian people from the new government or new cabinet are many, many. I can cite as examples three. One, reinforce the calming down of political sphere by concrete acts as appointment of the public administration of the militant of opposition, organization of political dialogue between the political actors, and two, accelerate the execution of social programs and policies in order to correct some disparities between some communities, some regions. Three, continue the policy of clean hands and tolerance zero regarding corruption.
Ambassador Mokhtar Dahi is a top former Mauritanian envoy to Italy. He spoke with me from the capital, Nouakchott. The Ghanaian Electoral Commission says it is so far pleased with the conduct of the voter registration process. The electoral body is compiling a voter list to be used for the upcoming December 7th general election. Ghanaians will go to the polls to choose a new president, parliament, and local-level representatives. Concerns were raised about the required documents needed for Ghanaians who are at least 18 years of age to register. Mrs. Sylvia Ano is the acting director of public affairs at the Electoral Commission. She explains to me the documents required for a prospective voter to register. She adds that the Electoral Commission continues to engage political parties and other stakeholders to ensure transparency in the run-up to the elections.
First and foremost, you need to have a Ghanaian passport or the NIE card. We call it the Ghana card. These two, yes.
Yeah, so if these two are not met, how can one qualify to meet the EC's requirement?
Alternatively, if you do not have any of these, meaning the Ghanaian passport or the NIA card, there's an opportunity for you to have two guarantors. And these guarantors must be registered voters who live in that particular area where you so decide to register as a voter. So you have an opportunity, window of opportunity, to have two guarantors.
there's currently a global coronavirus pandemic, and a lot of people are expressing concern that grouping people without any safety protocols could spread the disease or the virus. How is the Electoral Commission of Ghana managing the COVID situation during the ongoing voter registration process?
First and foremost, we did extensive publicity before the commencement of the exercise. And we indicated that we were going to put in safety measures right from the beginning of the process to the end. So before you go through the process, you are asked to wash your hands under running water with soap. You know, before you proceed, after checking your temperature with a thermometer gun, you are asked to proceed to wash your hands under running water with soap before you go on. And then you have the hand sanitizer being applied to your hands, and even before you leave the registration center. And then again, after you have placed your hands on the scanner, the scanner is disinfected or wiped. So we put in adequate measures. And then apart from all these, we marked the floor to ensure that we social distance from each other.
How will the Electoral Commission describe the conduct of this voter registration process so far?
People are very happy with the conduct of the exercise. And from our point of view, it's been very, very successful. And people have said that it's the best, you know, registration exercise we've had so far.
So has the Electoral Commission, in your view, been transparent with its dealings with stakeholders, including political parties and civil society groups?
Of course. The Electoral Commission engages all these stakeholders. We deem it a responsibility to meet with them from time to time, to explain issues to them, get feedback from them so we can be more transparent with them in our dealings, because we see them as our main stakeholders. So we deal with them virtually on a daily basis.
Some civil society groups and some opposition groups are saying that a section of the population in some regions are being prevented from registering to vote in the upcoming December 7 general election. When you hear such reports, how does the Electoral Commission resolve some of these concerns?
As far as we are concerned, we keep on keeping the enthusiasm of eligible applicants to come over to our centers to register. What we are not too sure is the accusations people are making, whether they are true or not. Because as far as we are concerned, we are rather encouraging qualified applicants to come over. And we've had reports also of some non-Ghanaians trying to cross over. And probably that is where they are met with stiff opposition from our security services. But so long as you're a Ghanaian citizen of 18 years and above and of sound mind, our doors are always open. So long as the registration is ongoing, we do not prevent anybody from registering so long as they are qualified. And let us also remember that there's division of labor. When it comes to security matters, we do not come in. We can only collaborate with the security services to make sure that there is law and order. We are playing a part effectively, and we are encouraging eligible applicants to turn up in their numbers so they can register.
Mrs. Sylvia Arnaud is the Acting Director of Public Affairs at the Electoral Commission. She spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. In Ivory Coast, a leading member of the opposition party, the Ivorian Popular Front, or FPI, says President Alassane Ouattara's decision to seek additional terms in office is a provocation that could plunge the country into chaos. Jean-Gervais Tshidi, a close ally of former President Laurent Gbagbo, says the constitution is explicit in the provision that limits a head of state to only 2 full-year terms. His remarks come after the incumbent president declared plans to represent the governing party in the upcoming October elections. Jean-Gervais Tshidi, a leading member of the opposition FPI, tells me that opponents of the president will use democratic means to let him know that his choices will undermine the country's peace and stability.
Our reaction as opposition party is that Mr. Ouattara is leading the country to new trouble, to a new bad situation. We are surprised and disappointed after this statement. He knows that he has no right to run for a third term, but he is doing so. This is a mere provocation. So we'll be trying to make him understand that he has to step down and finish his second term. He has no right to lead the country to a situation where we are going to have a new period of instability and difficult problems for the country.
But Mr. Chile, some people are suggesting that perhaps a court could decide whether it's a violation of the constitution or not. What is your position on that?
Well, this new constitution of 2016 is a constitution which has been written by his own expert. One article in this constitution, which is 183, something like that, says clearly that disposition of the second constitution will be implemented in this new constitution, which means clearly that the person who has already assumed two terms of ruling is not allowed by the new constitution to run again for the third term. So now the problem is going to be a question of interpretation. The main problem is that justice is not independent in our country at this moment. So which court will tell us that Mr. Ouattara, the head of state, is not in his right to run for the second term? Who is going to be the judge? Will he be courageous enough to say something different?
If the court cannot rule against President Ouattara as he seeks another term that you said violates the constitution, then what recourse do you have as opposition parties in Ivory Coast to challenge this, which you described as illegal?
Well, we have democratic wins, and we have public demonstration. We have all those means to make him understand that he cannot go further. Now, you will tell me that if he says no, what are you going to do? We are going to try what a Democrat politician must do for his country. In my party, our education is that we never use violence. We never resort to arms and everything to take power. Our only way to go to get to power is by the election.
Your party has chosen a former prime minister to be the presidential candidate. I also understand some supporters of former President Laurent Gbagbo, who you are very close with, are not happy that your party did not choose him as a presidential candidate. How do you resolve this?
Well, there is a confusion about the former prime minister. The former prime minister is no longer member of our party. The thing in Cote d'Ivoire is that Mr. Ouattara has succeeded in dividing the party, the most important party. Even if the majority of the members of the party do not support somebody, he will take that person to say that he is the leader of the party and he is the one he recognizes as the president of the party. That is exactly the situation right now in our party.
Some people are suggesting that to have any chance at all, Why aren't the opposition parties coming together to face him?
We have tried. We have tried. And we have been trying even up to 1 month ago. But the former prime minister you are talking about has suspended the negotiations to come together on his own. So we are watching him. We are watching him to know where he can go. He has already said that he is candidate. But in the same time, he's saying that if Mr. Gbagbo is accepted as a candidate, then he will resign in favor of Mr. Gbagbo.
Jean-Gervais Tshidé is a leading member of the opposition party, the Ivorian Popular Front, or FPI. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Abidjan.
Weekend's Encounter program, guest host VOA TV senior analyst Jeffrey Young discusses the hot issue of the West repatriating Africa's looted antiquities and artifacts. Western museums are reluctant to give back what colonialists looted centuries ago, but Africans insist that they be given back the works of their ancestors. Tune in this Saturday and Sunday to hear this discussion on VOA's Encounter.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the U.S.-Nigeria Law Group has presented evidence of atrocities being committed in parts of Nigeria to the Hague-based International Criminal Court, ICC. Attorney Emmanuel Ogebi, managing partner of the law group, says the move to petition the prosecutor of the court has generated support across Nigeria. The move, he says, is aimed at helping the ICC investigate possible genocide in the country. This after civil society groups and opposition parties expressed concern about a surge in insecurity. They cited instances of increased cases of kidnappings, alleged killings by Fulani herdsmen, as well as violence carried out by Boko Haram in several parts of the country. Attorney Ogebi tells me that his group continues to compile additional evidence to send to the Hague-based court for action.
Yes, there are two items that we wanted to share with the International Criminal Court. One of them is with regard to the Fulani herdsmen killers who have been wreaking havoc on Nigerian citizens and who last week were responsible for the death of over 60 people in southern Kaduna. And so the International Criminal Court has not yet established an examination of these crimes, which we consider to be crimes against humanity. And so we provided them with evidence showing the pictures and the attacks that occurred. The second issue that we raised was with regard to Boko Haram as well. They too also executed five aid workers. And again, the ICC has not taken a definitive position on the issue of Boko Haram. So we also petitioned them about it.
Do you think your petition and the evidence that you have presented to the International Criminal Court will meet the court threshold to perhaps even begin an investigation into some of these allegations you are making?
Absolutely. I mean, we clearly looked at the indicators that the court need to begin prosecution of crimes against humanity. And one of the factors they have to look at is that the local courts in the country in question are not providing justice for victims and holding terrorists accountable. And one of the pieces of evidence we submitted was a report that a senator from the Northeast said that Nigerian government released 601 Boko Haram terrorists and that already one of them has gone and killed his father and stolen his items and disappeared, possibly to rejoin the terrorist group. So this is a very compelling piece of evidence that has been given to us. Now, after we sent in the report, I also received another report today that the soldiers have complained that they saw Boko Haram suspects who were released fighting them back again in the bush. So clearly, there's no doubt that, you know, this means that Nigeria has not adequately addressed the situation and the ICC's jurisdiction should be invoked.
Officials of the administration have repeatedly said they have stepped up security efforts. The president on occasions have met with service chiefs and given them instructions to defeat the insurgent groups, including Boko Haram. Are you saying all these efforts are not worthy to pursue, but rather an international body like the International Criminal Court should come in? Because supporters are saying that undermines the territorial integrity and sovereignty of the Republic of Nigeria.
Let me give you just one example of what is happening. The service chiefs who are continuing to serve illegally because their tenures have expired have no incentive to perform because the government of General Buhari has accepted failure as a policy of governance. Two service chiefs, as we speak, are building universities in their villages. Troops are complaining about lack of resources to fight. A general who complained has been court-martialed. And, you know, you can see that just this week, the governor of Borno State was ambushed. And this was recorded on TV. And he actually engaged, you know, with the attackers. And later on, he told the government, the military, that why are they claiming to have defeated Boko Haram when he himself was attacked? So, I mean, the fact that these atrocities continue is a clear indication that the administration has failed in its efforts to contain the conflict. And as I said in our petition to the ICC, President Yar'Adua, who was just a lecturer, has performed better in security than General Buhari, who is a retired Major General of the Nigerian Army.
What's next for your group in this, your quest to have the Hague-based court to look into some of these atrocities you allege?
Well, this past week, we have submitted two petitions. One was a public petition, and the second one was exhibits. We will continue to inundate the court with exhibits and evidence until we make a historical record that they failed to respond to an ongoing genocide, despite all the evidence being available to them. And not only will we share the evidence with them, we will share it with the public. Look at what happened in the United States. When people saw the video of George Floyd, it sparked a global response. And what is happening in Nigeria is more than what happened to George Floyd.
Attorney Emmanuel Ogebe is managing partner of the U.S.-Nigeria Law Group. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. The Interreligious Council of Uganda, an umbrella organization representing the seven major religious groups, is advocating for persons with disabilities. This after the group launched a series of educational activities as part of an effort to influence policies favorable towards persons with disabilities. Sheikh Waisiwa Mohammed Ali, an executive member of the Interreligious Council, says the group's effort is gaining traction. Civil society groups have expressed concern that persons with disabilities are the most impacted following movement restrictions imposed by the government to stop the spread of the coronavirus. They called on the administration to provide them with food and other supplies to help them cope with the economic impact of the disease. Sheikh Ali tells me that the Interreligious Council of Uganda is engaging the government and other stakeholders as it works to assist persons with disabilities during the coronavirus crisis.
The Interreligious Council will do influence policies to promote the welfare of disabled at the government, parliament, public institutions, and religious institutions as well. This has helped to enable the people with disabilities to be represented at parliament, and this representation is from all constituencies of Uganda. Also, it has enabled the institutions of higher learning to accept people with disabilities and provide facilities for them, like the ramps and wheelchairs and things like that, and even the blind, provide them with the tools they can use to study. And also, they are offered extra help, like scholarships and bursaries, especially for those who are excellently performing.
What about the issue of measures implemented to help people living with disabilities in Uganda, particularly because of restrictions imposed by the government to stop or limit the spread of the coronavirus? What are you doing to help people living with disabilities in this global pandemic?
Well, you see, the pandemic is really a challenge, but so far we are able to reach them in their respective homes. We are using media to reach all the people that we need to reach to, especially the people with a disability, especially in the way of helping them to attain their needs. If they do require, for instance, assistance to hospitals, we transport them. We provide them transport. And they're already aware there is an open line with the Interreligious Council of Uganda. Whenever they have a concern and a problem, they always approach us for help and things like that.
With your advocacy group, is there a recognition or an acceptance across the Ugandan landscape, particularly when it comes to education, health, among other sectors of Uganda?
Yes, because we are spreading awareness both to the parents, guardians, and the people with a disability themselves. You know, previously, parents used to think that people with a disability cannot do anything and they are not a priority. But we try to counsel them, guide them, provide them with the necessary career guidance. And ideally, we have very good examples of the people with the disabilities who have extremely performed highly, better than the people who are able. And therefore, we emphasize the fact that disability is not inability, and that should not be an excuse for discriminating them. So we are working along those lines to provide necessary guidance, counseling, and career guidance to all the stakeholders in as far as the issue of disability is concerned.
Talking about all stakeholders, how are you engaging the government to enact what you call favorable or right policies that will be beneficial to people living with disabilities?
Well, we occasionally have opportunities to interact with the parliament, with the committees of parliament, the committee of health, the committee of social welfare, the committee, so many of them. We meet them differently, legal committees and so on and so forth. And through such opportunities, we actually engage them to improve on the rights of the people living with a disability. And fortunate that the people with a disability themselves are now members of parliament. They are also in various committees of parliament, which means they can push the agenda. And we merely bring to their notification things that do not seem to go well, and therefore they carry on the agenda.
Sheikh Waisiwa Muhammad Ali is an executive member of the Interreligious Council of Uganda. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Surging floodwaters in the southern regions of Somalia have driven more than 650,000 people to flee their homes this year. The UN Refugee Agency reports the flooding has caused food shortages, led to the outbreak of killer diseases, and increased the risk of the coronavirus spreading in the country. WA Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
More than 150,000 of the flood victims have become homeless since late June, including 23,000 in just the past week, according to officials. Weather forecasters warn the worst is not over yet. They predict the heavy rains and extreme flooding will continue for some time in certain regions and exacerbate the living conditions of the hundreds of thousands of displaced. The UN Refugee Agency spokesman Charlie Yaxley reports many of the newly displaced are living in overcrowded, makeshift shelters with little protection from the harsh weather. He says families are exposed to increased risk of crimes, such as robbery and rape.
Food is in short supply and many are going hungry, with rising malnutrition in children, leaving them at risk of starvation. Sanitary conditions are poor and access to medical care is scarce, and health partners warn of a risk of diarrhea, vector-borne diseases, respiratory tract infections, and other communicable diseases rapidly spreading amongst the displaced population.
Yaxley says there has been no reported major coronavirus outbreak, but he tells VOA the outlook is not good. He says people have little access to clean water. The cramped quarters prevent social distancing, and very little sanitation infrastructure is in place.
So conditions are ripe for transmission of viruses, including COVID-19. And this is exacerbated even further because in some areas, we're not able to access some of the affected communities. In some areas, particularly in the southern parts that are controlled by armed groups and militias.
COVID-19 is the disease caused by the coronavirus. He actually says the UNHCR and other humanitarian agencies are not able to reach those areas and deliver assistance. He says the many people living there are largely left to fend for themselves. He actually says aid agencies are doing their best to deliver medical and personal protective equipment, as well as make people aware of the hygiene measures needed to mitigate COVID-19 and other diseases. The UNHCR is urgently appealing to the international community to support its relief efforts. The agency has appealed for $154 million to protect and provide for the needs of an estimated 2.6 million internally displaced people and 30,000 refugees and asylum seekers. The agency says so far it has received only 33% of what it needs to carry out its life-saving mission. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Right now it's time for music from our African collection.
ever get a girl like me, me. Me say yes, my love. Would you love? Give me a dirty foot and dirt and not beer. Sweat I run like bull pant trap. I me have good comfort. Yeah. Me sitting blessing, hold him from a catching. Save him from past pussy where depressing. Touch you make you feel good. Slappy headings. Do I'm a fat you could swear say you're selling. You excite me like action shows. Stick with your true highs and lows. Now chatty silent and 6 tiptoes. Cause I love it when me take all your inches blunt. Big tongue so tell you like the throat. Turn your one come on body hot like throat. Me have something for your boss bout. Plus my free give me like a chow. Fight be going sometimes. Feels tight so me give you some trouble, trouble. But I paradise inside and me boom boom comfortable. Regular him to be a big love. Be my love. Make him come right back. Never get a girl like me, me. Me say yes, my love. Would you love? Give me a bloody a fuck and dirt and not beer. Sweat I run like boat and trap. I me have good comfort. Yeah. Baby, love me, my love. Good comfort. Never get a girl like me. I shouldn't see her.
Yeah.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the dawn does not come twice to wake a person up. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.